Hello everyone, welcome to the final episode of Season 5. It's my second special postbag edition. It's really flown by, hasn't it? The first episode of this season started way back just before Christmas. And now, it's spring. So, postbag edition, this is a chance for me to read out any of your comments, questions and queries about past topics, as well as any other food history questions that you might have in general. Now, if you're listening to this and thinking, I had something to say or something to ask and I'm too late, don't worry, contact me anyway, because there will be another postbag edition. Email me, neil@britishfoodhistory.com, or send me a DM on Twitter, @neilbuttery, or Instagram, dr_neil_buttery. Leave a message in the comments, or maybe put a post on the new British Food History Facebook discussion page, which can be found at facebook.com/groups/British Food History. Don't worry, there's info in the show notes. Okay, before we begin the episode properly, let's just listen to this very short message.
Hello, this is Tom Dinas, the host of the Delicious Legacy podcast, a podcast all about food and history. As fans of the British food history, I know you have a bottomless appetite for all dusty recipes, unknown herbs, mysterious spices, and long-lost ingredients. So, why don't you join me? You can find the Delicious Legacy podcast wherever you listen to quality podcasts, such as The British Food History, and also on Twitter and Instagram. And now back to your regular program.
Now, before I start whittering on, I just want to pause and say thank you to you. You're a listener. Maybe you have followed, liked, or reviewed the podcast. Maybe you've told your friends, family, or colleagues about it. You might even have treated me to a virtual pint or virtual coffee, or maybe started up a £3 subscription in return for those Easter eggs, premium blog content, and the monthly newsletter. Whichever one of those you have done, I salute you. The podcast continues to climb the charts, so whatever you're doing is working. And all those people who have donated something, you know, I'm so pleased that you have. In fact, it's remarkable that you have. If I was a religious person, I'd be saying I feel blessed right now. But I'm not religious, so I'm not going to say that. A massive thank you to all of my fantastic guests for coming on and making this season such a successful one. Annie Gray, Paula McIntyre, Charlie Taverner, Ivan Day, Lindsay Middleton, Rachel Green, and Alessandra Pino. Every single episode has been an absolute joy to edit, and I do so hope you come on again to have another chit-chat with me about British food and history. So, I've got some news. The Elizabeth Raffle book, Before Mrs. Beaton, there's an update. I was banging on last episode, wasn't I, about how it's going to be released on the 30th of February? Well, it's been held up. There's an issue, apparently, with Dispatch. So there's a new publication that Pen and Sword History have given, and that's of 30th of March, which feels like ages away, but that's a worst case scenario, and they expect it to be sorted before then. I must admit, I chucked my toys out of the pram when I heard about it, but I'm over it, and it's like, okay, fine. Hey, but the book has been doing well. It went top 10 in British historical biographies in Amazon, and it was the number 2 bestseller on the Pen and Sword website, so again, thank you very much if you've pre-ordered. One good thing is, that means there's a month extension on getting the early bird discount of 20% from the Pen and Sword History website. And aside from Before Mrs. Beaton, of course, there's my previous book, A Dark History of Sugar, also available from the publisher or from any good bookshop. Even though this is the last episode of the podcast, there's going to be lots of raffled content on the blog and my social media, plus extra things just for subscribers, of course. I'll talk about that a bit more at the end, though. One other thing, I recently appeared on the Food Matters Live podcast, discussing food innovations past, present and future. It's close to a century of the invention of the bread slicing machine, you see. So there's the host, Stefan Gates, and the other guest that came on with me is food futurologist, Dr. Margen Gay. What do we think is the best thing since sliced bread? Well, for starters, not sliced bread. Check it out if you've got the time. I'll put the link in the show notes. Okay, let's have a look at some listeners' questions and letters about previous episodes. I got a couple of messages about invalid food. Remember I talked about that with Lindsay Middleton. I got a Twitter message from Eric the Baker. He says, I was an American child of Eastern European immigrants, grandparents, When I was sick, I got chicken broth, not freshly made, but from a can. Mum abandoned parts of her heritage as soon as possible. My wife's family has been American for much longer. She got tapioca pudding and cream of wheat. And he's also said there was a phrase, sugar makes you feel better. Well, yes, I mean, yeah, it does, doesn't it? In fact, sweet chicken broth, which is, well, is it the best of both worlds? I don't know, but that was certainly popular in the Middle Ages for those who could afford it. I think I mentioned in the sugar book that Edward I gave his rather sickly son sweet chicken broth to try and ease his weak chest. It didn't work, unfortunately. But yes, there's various versions of all of the different chicken broths we go to whenever we're feeling sick. Just talking about it now, I realised that I did have an invalid food and I'd completely forgotten until right now, and that was chicken noodle soup, but it was in a packet and it was by Knorr. I don't know if it's still made. I'm going to have to check that out now. I approve of Eric's list. I really love tapioca pudding and sago pudding. I've only ever had it at school or from a can. I think Ambrosia used to make it. Do they still make it? Can you still buy things like that in cans? Probably not. No one eats this kind of stuff anymore, do they? I should have a go at making it. I know some people hate all those milky, maybe custard-like desserts, but I absolutely love them. I've never had cream of wheat, though. Although I lived in the US a couple of years, it's not one of the things I got round to trying. I understand it's a bit like a kind of porridge, but made from wheat. Anyway, it's in that realm, so as far as I'm concerned, it's going to be great. I realise that some of you are probably feeling queasy at the thought of wheat porridge. Rob Marston DM'd me on Twitter to say that in his house, growing up as a kid, sliced cheddar, sliced onion and milk at the bottom of the oven at a very low temperature was baked. He says his mother made it for his father throughout the 50s, 60s and 70s. They were both working class and from Salford. I mean, I'd eat that, ill or not. It sounds pretty good to me. It's almost like a stewed cheese, which appears in a lot of old recipes. And these kind of things are very delicious. So I approve of that. That's fine. There is one thing that I did remember. I've never had this, but a lot of people seem to talk about, at least in England anyway, in the north of England, is whenever they were sick, they'd be laid out on the sofa watching TV or whatever, and their mum would bring them chopped up hard-boiled egg in a cup to eat, which for some reason makes me feel queasy, and I don't know why that is. I guess it's like it's pre-masticated or something, and no one wants to eat an egg that's been pre-masticated now, do they? Funny, isn't it, what turns your stomach? I can eat brains and testicles, but chopped up egg in a cup weirds me out. We're a funny animal, aren't we? Helen Gray emailed me to say that she got into experimenting with cooking traditional British food after finding a 1930s cookbook in a wardrobe of a house that she'd moved into in the mid-1990s. I love it when we find these things. Most people, she says, as you are quite right in pointing out, were very sniffy at the thought of traditional food and not keen to try my efforts. She also goes on to say, no one was keen to try my forage food meals in the 1990s either, and look where we are now with that. You see, Helen, you and I, we knew about these things. So I'll come around again. She says, for the last 10 years, I have had a more favourable audience and it's given her more of a sense of experimentation and adventure. I haven't gone too far down the offal route, she says, although I did have a crack at making faggots, being from the West Country, and they were delicious. They are delicious. We talked about faggots with Rachel Green, didn't we, on the Traditional Foods of Lancashire episode. Down south, it's made with pork and pork offal and breadcrumbs. As you go further north, pork is replaced by lamb offal, although a bit of pork belly and maybe a bit of bacon still goes in there. Also, as you go north, breadcrumbs are swapped for oats. And I've got a theory that's a bit of a spectrum of faggot going from the south, starting porky and bready, going up more oatmeal-y, more lamby, until you pop over the border between England and Scotland, and there you have the haggis, which is basically just a great big lamb faggot, isn't it? That's my theory. It's probably nonsense. She said, and this was sent to me just before Christmas, she was going to hold a 12th night gathering, and this year she'd taken some recipes from Annie Gray's book. She's going to try the pepper cake, the 12th night cake, and I'm quoting her here, the heavenly sounding wine chocolate. I've never had pepper cake or wine chocolate, the latter being the one I really want to try. I mean, I can't eat chocolate. It really upsets my stomach, but it's not going to kill me. So maybe I should give it a go. Maybe it should be next Christmas's hot, boozy, seasonal drink. Because I do one every year. So maybe I'll do that. I shall write it down. Somebody emailed me. I don't know their name. Just that they came from Ty Neward Farm. They DM me via Instagram because they'd heard Annie's discussion about wassail, and they sent me a link to the Chambers Book of Days, which is an online searchable miscellany of writings collected from antiquity. And it's a great resource there for anybody who's interested in, well, customs in general. And there's a lot about food in there. In fact, it's now favourited in my search bar. There's quite a bit of information about wassail with a recipe, why wassail might have petered out as a drink, and there's also some stuff on the Scottish wassail, although they don't call it this, but I believe it's called a het pint. And going back to the episode about Hogmanay with Paula McIntyre, on her Hogmanay special TV show, she makes a het pint, and it is very similar to wassail, or at least the wassail that Annie Gray gives in her book. It's got ale and it's thickened just very slightly, just to make it silky with egg yolk. I really liked this quote. It says, "The wassail bowl is Shakespeare's gossip bowl in the Midsummer Night's Dream. The composition was ale, nutmeg, sugar, toast, and roasted crabs or apples." By roasted crabs, he means crab apples, not the little creature. And the word wassail comes from washail, which means to grow or become well. There's a link there with Orchard Blessings, when people used to do the wassail on Twelfth Night. Sprinkle a bit of wassail, drink a bit of wassail, shout a bit of wassail. The idea being that the orchard too will grow and become well, and there'll be a really good harvest come the autumn. So check that out. All the links to everything that I'm talking about is in the show notes. All right, Lincolnshire Chine. James McLaren sent me a message on Twitter. He says, "When the BBC did a series about forgotten or endangered foods, Clarissa Dixon Wright," she's one of my food heroes, I absolutely love her, "did an episode on pork, which included at least reference to chine." Now, she did indeed, and that episode is on YouTube for you to watch. So thank you, James. It's a really interesting episode. And on that episode is the reasoning why the strange cup peculiar to Lincolnshire even exists. And I suppose the reason why we don't see it anymore. And the reason is the Lincolnshire curly coated pig had really thick fat. We're talking 6, 7, or even more inches of back fat. So when butchers needed to cut up the pig, it was easier to go in through the abdominal cavity and cut through there. So that's why you got the spine, i.e. the chine, cut at either side. So that's why you got that unique shape. Now, pigs don't have that much fat these days. Even the really fatty pigs like Gloucester Old Spots, you can still butcher them in a regular way. So that seems to be why the old-fashioned chine cut has also disappeared, because the curly-coated pig has disappeared. Food historian Mark Dawson alerted me to more information about Lincolnshire chine. And again, there's a hyperlink in the show notes for anybody who wants to seek this out. He said, "Lincolnshire chine is great," and it really is. I did enjoy it very much, in case you didn't see my blog post about it. He says, "We had a talk at the Leeds Food and History Symposium some years ago by Eric Phipps, a retired butcher from Louth, and it was all written up in PPC back in 2010, and they published it recently as part of the Pigs volume of proceedings of that symposium. He's left me a link. You can have a look at it on Google Books. Thank you very much, Mark. Christopher Monk, previous guest and friend of the show, he appeared on, what was it, Season 2, Episode 2, Form of Curry. He alerted me to a BBC News article, "Ancient Eel Migration Mystery Unraveled." Okay, so this goes back to Season 2 as well, and Episode 4, if I remember rightly, the Elvers episode. Elvers are just baby eels, eel fry. It's a mystery about where eels actually spawn. They all swim down the rivers into the sea and spawn somewhere mysterious. We know it's a Sargasso Sea, somewhere in the Bermuda Triangle. So I was very excited, a bit like when somebody announces that they found the proof of Bigfoot or something like that. This is what the article said on the BBC. "By fitting eels with satellite tags, researchers have tracked the creatures on the final leg of the route, and they say the information will help in the conservation of the critically endangered species. This is the first time we've been able to track eels to the Sargasso Sea, and we are delighted we have the first direct evidence of adult European eels reaching their spawning area," said Ross White of the Environment Agency, who led the research, their journey will reveal information about eel migration that's never been known before. I think we knew all that already. But okay, we've got some actual data points. But they still haven't been seen, and they still haven't been found. So like Bigfoot, I am claiming that this is still a mystery, unless you, dear listener, have some information that I am not party to. If you do, please let me know. I'm going to return to letters in a little bit, but first I'm going to tell you about some upcoming events that you might be interested in if you're in the UK. I have had a message from previous guest, Season 2, Episode 6, Andrew Kerr of the Sustainable Eel Group. Yes, more eels. Newbies to the podcast might not know, but eels and eel conservation are very close to my heart. I did a trio of episodes about them. Check them out if you haven't already. But anyway, he sent me some information about the Wilder Wedmore Eel Release Project. Now, I'm going to read from their website. Their aim is to help eels through assisted migration in the Somerset wetlands by moving elvers, caught responsibly, below the barriers and obstructions of local rivers, and then release them upstream into nursery habitats, so reducing mortality and enabling greater distribution. Green Wedmore is working closely with the Sustainable Eel Group, a Europe-wide conservation and science-led organisation which exists to accelerate the eel's recovery. We are aiming to release up to 1 million young elvers, and for this, we are looking to raise in excess of £10,000. Now, this is where we've got to. The elver fishermen, their lives are being so disrupted by people like the Environment Agency and by Brexit that now we've got to rely on charity to get something that was just done every year by the fishermen and working perfectly fine. It wasn't broke, it didn't need fixing, but it got broken anyway. So there's going to be a festival, the 9th to 11th of June. I've left a link in the show notes for those who might be interested in supporting this great effort. There's also a link for anybody who might want to donate to the Wilder Wedmore Eel Release Project. They're doing pretty well, but they are not at £10,000 yet. And I'm sure they would be very grateful if you chuck them a couple of quid. Also, this year is the 37th Leeds Symposium on Food History and Traditions. It's held in York, not Leeds, which I know is a bit confusing. It's on Saturday the 20th of May 2023. The theme this year, there's a theme every year, is celebrations. Last year I spoke about Kelsoprese eels. This year I won't be speaking, but I am still attending, and there's some really good speakers. Let me tell you a little bit about them. There's Mark Meltonville, who will consider what sort of celebrations might have taken place at Stonehenge. Ivan Day, previous guest, will then look at a number of English coronation feasts over the years, which is perfect timing because I think it's maybe the week before the coronation, the week after the coronation. Anyway, it's very timely. Peter Breers, who's a fantastic historian, will look at civic feasts in Yorkshire. Sarah Maltby will then turn to community celebrations of royal jubilees and coronations. And finally, Sue Bailey will show how town and gown came together in Cambridge to celebrate Queen Victoria's coronation. It's a really good, friendly event. I'm very nervous when it comes to these sorts of things. In real life, I'm quite shy. But you are guaranteed to feel welcome. It's a single day. It's also affordable. It's 25 quid. And I heartily recommend it. So perhaps I'll see you there. Okay, let's have a look at a couple of suggestions for future episodes. Chris Curtis messaged me. He says, at some point, I'd love to see a podcast on pies. I've always liked them, and I've recently started making them, especially raised pies. Good to hear, they're very satisfying to make. He goes on to say, something I can't quite work out is how and why pies went from being a way of cooking and preserving meat in pastry, e.g. like a pork pie, to the present situation of essentially a stew served in a pastry case. I like both, he says, but in my mind, they are very different. I suspect, although it's never clear in old recipes, that historically, pies were almost always served cold. Well, they sometimes were, they sometimes weren't. It's a murky world because the information isn't always there in the manuscripts, especially when you go right back to medieval times. It's up for discussion whether the pastry used to make pies in the Middle Ages was eaten at all. Some people think it was just broken open so you could get to the filling. The really early ones where it was certainly not eaten, well, they were called coffins. This early way of making pies, i.e. just making your own pot out of pastry, essentially, because earthenware was so expensive, they evolved into pork pies, and it evolved into things like terrines and pâtés in France. In fact, the word pâté comes from the word paste, i.e. pastry. He says, "You seem to have made a lot of raised pies in your time." I certainly have. "Have you ever made a pie entirely free-form? In modern recipes, we're told to use either a pie dolly or a jam jar, or to line a mould with the pastry. In Eliza Acton's book, she writes of a French technique that involves first shaping the pastry into a sugar loaf shape, then pressing the point down and inward, forming the case entirely by hand. He says, "I gave it a go and found it easier than using a jam jar. I tried a bit of Googling to see if this is still done in France, but I couldn't work out if they still use hot water pastry there." Well, I have made them freeform with mixed results. I've done smaller ones, and just like you say, although I'd never heard it described like a sugar loaf shape, it does work. Although it's not quite as pointy as a sugar loaf. But the idea is, of course, it just all leans in. That does work well. When you get really big, it does not work well, because now, infamously, that's the method I use for making the Yorkshire Christmas pie, and that was a massive disaster. The trick to it, I think, is having a cool place to work. If you form your case out of your hot water pastry and leave it to cool properly and stiffen up, it takes maybe a couple of days. It's really quite rigid, and you can add your filling and seal it with a lid. The French do still use water and flour mixtures for their pies, and they work very well. At least that's how it looks. Although, I have to say, I've tried them and it just ends up pretty tough, so I don't know what I'm doing wrong. Adding some melted lard, or even a bit of butter, which I think is too rich. I think lard is better. But adding a bit of fat just changes things so much more, and you get a shorter, crumblier, and more delicious pastry, in my opinion. Jen Grigson has some good advice on pie making in English food. I've written posts on that on the Neil Cooks Grigson website in the past, so I'll leave a link in the show notes to those. I know outside of the UK, these large cold meat pies seem a bit alien and weird, but they are really good. So if you're not sure or you want to have a go, plenty of recipes on my Grigson blog. Check those out. Gary Goff DM'd me on Instagram to say, "Firstly, I would just like to say thank you for such a fantastic and informative podcast." Thanks, Gary. He has a request. He says, "Although Devonian, the greatest food ever, I think, comes from my sister county, the humble Cornish pasty. Is it possible you could do an episode and debunk all the myths regarding this amazing food?" Well, there's a lot of myths that do need debunking, I must say. And of course, if you're Devonian, Gary, you could have a Devonshire pasty, which I believe is exactly the same as a Cornish pasty, except the crimp goes over the top instead of going round the side. It's basically the same. It's just like the cream tea, where do you put jam first or cream first? It all goes down the same hole. It's all the same stuff. It doesn't matter. I'm sure you'll agree that pies, raised pies, pasties, they're all in the same realm. And I had actually planned to do an episode on pies and pasties. Well, it wasn't even this season, it was a season before, but things just didn't go to plan. However, I have made an episode that covers both of these, or rather, I've been the guest on one talking about it. It's very exciting because I'm a guest on Tony Robinson's podcast, Cunningcast, talking about this. I'm not sure when the episode is coming out, but it's very exciting. I'm a huge fan of Tony Robinson's. I'm a big Blackadder fan, and of course he did Time Team, made Marian and the Merry Men. Yeah, one of my comedy heroes. I tried to keep my cool. I think I did. I made a couple of fluffs. But that'll be out soon. Also, there's a Cornish pasty post on my blog, British Food History. Some myths are debunked on there, so hopefully I've ticked Chris's box and Gary's box as well. Remember, if you've got any suggestions for future episodes, please contact me. It might not end up being an episode, I can't promise that, but it might become a blog post. Or it might even, like pies and pasties, end up on the episode of another podcast. Okay, let's look at more questions. This is a bit of a random mixed bag. Some people message me to ask me questions out of the blue. I don't think they're even aware that I do a podcast. So I'm going to read some of those out. I'm not going to give out names because they weren't expecting to be the podcast. Sometimes I message them back to say, do you mind? But sometimes they don't get back to me, so I shan't assume. Anyway, somebody messaged me saying, I'm attempting to write a novel set in the early 18th century. I realise that ladies did not have high tea until Victorian times. Was there an equivalent meal during the 18th century? Did the nobility have snacks, stroke finger foods, as they entertained their guests? So, well, first of all, tea time began in the 18th century. In the second half, tea was being drunk much before that, but the institution that was tea time, at least as we think of it, second half of the 18th century. But the short answer is, until that developed, what meal did they have? Well, they had dinner. Dinner had to be eaten much earlier. Candles were very expensive. So dinner, which took a while, was eaten when it was still light outside. It was only in the second half of the 18th century, when candles became cheap enough to light dining rooms in the evenings, did dinner move into the evening time. But by the time you get to 3 or 4 o'clock, people found themselves very hungry. So tea time appeared to plug that gap. And that was low tea by your well-to-do people. Called low tea because it was on a low table, it was less formal, and it was some cakes and a cup of tea and a chance to have a chat. High tea, well, that's what the more working classes had. It was called high tea because it was put on the dining table, so a higher table, not just a little low down side table, and that became a meal in itself. So that's why in the south of England, people call their evening meal dinner. In the north of England, they call them tea, because these differences, at least in name, still exist. I hope that's answered your question. Mary Gibson emailed me. Well, this wasn't much of a question, more an ask. She has the idea of starting up some kind of national food society for the UK, a place where we can swap ideas, she says, recipes and techniques. She mentions the Oxford Food Symposium. It's very popular. It's pretty pricey. I can't afford to go to it, for sure. It lasts about 4 days. So just let me refer back to the Leeds / York Food Symposium. That's all done in a day. It costs 25 quid. There's no expensive meals. There's no expensive room to rent for the weekend. And what's really good is people bring some home-cooked food, traditional, usually British food or historical food for the buffet. If a National Food Society did exist, though, Mary hopes that the society would be a kind of a mix of everything, with everything being achievable and not too academic. Now, I agree with this. Scholarly, yes, that's always good. But sometimes we get bogged down in the academia. I think food history has to appeal to a broader set of people. This is something I've discussed with people in the past, other food historians. So the interest is there. What do we do about it? Well, I'm not sure about that. If anybody's interested in following Mary on Instagram, she's at the Cookery Club 25. That's all one word. 25 is just 25, the numbers. But there are people doing this in their own way. Paul Couchman is also known as the Regency Cook. If you follow me on Twitter and Instagram, the chances are you follow him too. And if you don't, you've probably seen our interactions. He's running at the minute at what he calls a gentle introduction to Georgian cookery, where he's walking people through the different foods and techniques and the ways of serving food, but it's also really well researched. Now, this course has already begun. In fact, I've signed myself up for it, but I think he's doing more courses in the future. So make sure you follow him on Twitter and Instagram, the Regency Cook. I will, of course, leave information in the show notes. There's a lot of show notes to go with this episode, folks. Now, Matthew, who's written in before to the Postbag edition, Matthew spelled M-A-F-F-Y-O-U, he said, when I was listening to the season 5, episode 4 of the podcast, 18th Century Dining with Ivan Day, we discussed crockery and utensils and the controversial introduction of the fork. So I was wondering, he says, is there a utensil or some kitchen equipment you look at and think, if only people knew the history of this item? Good question. I think there's only one answer to this, and I'm sorry if it's a very obvious answer, but I think it has to be the oven. How it's changed through the millennia from, well, a fire outside to a simple central fire in a room where the smoke goes out the centre It's not just the technology that's changed through the years, how we've gone from a fire to a microwave and all the other different things we have today, but it's a social element too. The fire, the warmth, the helping, the family doesn't do that as well these days, does it? Now, Ivan Day actually edited a book on this subject, and historian Ruth Goodman, who appears on TV every now and again, often with Ivan Day, in fact, she's fantastic. She's written a book on the subject of the oven. So leave this one with me. I think a future podcast episode has been hatched. So I've written a note. I'm going to see what I can do. Watch this space. One thing I did think about, and that's one thing that's never changed for centuries, possibly millennia, and that's the wooden spoon. How far back does it go? I don't know. I'm sure somebody knows. But you go back centuries and centuries, and it's there. It's still the best thing that we have for its task, stirring hot things in pans. I think the wooden spoon is quite possibly the most important kitchen utensil that's ever been. I'm going to stick my neck out and say that. Thank you, Matthew. I got an email from Debbie Hurrell asking, I wonder if you can give me any information about the origin of suet pudding. This is something my Scottish grandmother would make once a year. It was cooked by steaming it or boiling it in a cotton cloth bag, and then it was sliced and served with a jus and roast beef. I mean, that's a very classic, traditional British combination. Roast beef and a suet pudding. Something that doesn't exist anymore, so I'm glad some people remember having it. It sounds like, and I'm making a leap here, and I might be wrong, but it sounds like your grandmother, since it was an annual thing, was perhaps making a clouty dumpling, something I discussed with Paula McIntyre for the Hogmanay episode. It's hard to pin down the origins to these things, however, but puddings were cooked in cloths, like what you described by your grandmother, from the 16th century. Before that, they were cooked in animal intestines, and we still have a few puddings that are like that, because we've got black pudding, white pudding, hog's pudding. They go really far back. Some are sweet, some are savoury. Some sweet puddings that are still enjoyed today have their roots in intestines. Bread pudding or bread and butter pudding, originally cooked in intestines, as was rice pudding. So there you go. In fact, I've made rice pudding in an intestine and it was absolutely delicious. I keep meaning to do the recipe and putting it on the blog or on Instagram or something. I'll try and get that done this year. So I'm not sure if I'm really answering your question, Debbie. Puddings are just, they're so old, they possibly go right back to the Romans, or they're probably even prehistoric. Who came up with the first suet and flour stroke oats mixture? Well, I mean, we just don't know the answer to that one. Or they're certainly part of the fabric of British cuisine. And if we took them out, British cuisine would be a much poorer thing. The problem is that particular combination, one that we used to be so proud about in this country, that combination of boiled or steamed suet pudding, cooked in a cloth, with roast beef, just not done anymore. It used to be the national dish. Well, I did a Christmas special about Christmas puddings a couple of years ago, and we talked about clouty dumplings with Paula, so I feel like it's kind of covered. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to do a blog post on that uniquely British combination, so keep an eye out for that. Stefano Arturi, I hope I've pronounced that properly, Stefano. Also known as Italian Home Cooking on Instagram, he messaged me a question. He asked, in relation to food of the past, in the way it emerges from books like Hannah Glass's, Elizabeth Raffles, Eliza Acton's, etc., how would you define contemporary British food? What identity does it have? Well, that is a good question. It's a tricky one. I think it's tricky when you're British. And I think we don't really see what British is. It's something we always have trouble identifying. I think people who aren't British do a much better job of this. There's lots of great French cooks from the past. Alexis Soyer, for example, is probably the best known. Francatelli is another example. French chefs coming to this country and doing really good British food. They definitely can see what makes something British or English much better than we can. And in fact, going back to a previous episode, not from this season, but the season before, with Ben Mervis, when we talked about the British cookbook, I think he did a very good job. And the fact that he's American and not British, I think that's got a lot to do with why he did such a good job. But anyway, going back to your question, I mean, it's difficult to say. I do talk about it in the Elizabeth Raffle book, but certainly food went through a bottleneck in the 18th century with Hannah Glass, Elizabeth Raffold, Eliza Smith, Elizabeth Moxon. There's lots of female cookery book writers in that period. Food went through a bottleneck because what they were doing was taking the best food that already existed, but chucking away a lot of the medieval food, and certainly chucking away the royal court cookery. So what you had was just a handful of female writers writing recipes for the kind of food that people were eating every day, albeit fairly well-to-do people, I admit. And then when you got plagiarisation of those books by men, and certainly by Mrs. Beaton, when you get into the 19th century, that what you've really got is a small number of recipes being cooked all over the country. So we're getting some kind of national identity at that point. That's what I mean by the bottleneck of recipes. We went from thousands to a few. At this time also, food becomes regional in name. This is when you get things like Yorkshire pudding appearing. Of course, Yorkshire pudding, as we know from the Yorkshire pudding episode we did, not this season, but the season before, it was just a dripping pudding or a batter pudding. But suddenly it becomes from Yorkshire. In one edition of Hannah Glass's Art of Cookery Make Plain and Easy, she has recipes. It's not the first edition. It's something like the 8th or the 10th or something like that. And she has 10 different pancake recipes, each one being from a different county and each one just being different by one ingredient. I mean, I'm kind of making these up, but Norfolk one, that has mace in it. Somerset one, oh, well, that has nutmeg in it. And they're all basically the same, except for one thing swapped out. So that's where identity, British identity, comes from. A few writers, very popular. Those recipes were plagiarised. And I think modern British cookery can still be traced back to that, especially now when we're in a period where we're reflecting on our traditions. Sometimes we look inward, sometimes we look outward. At the minute, we're looking inward, which I think is always a good thing, because it means traditional food is being cooked more around the country. I think that's what's happening anyway. So yes, in the 18th century, your Raffolds, your Glasses, Eliza Smiths, their contemporary cooking, which was copied, rehashed, republished for decades and decades, and well, 1.5 centuries, you know, their contemporary cooking became our traditional British food. Is that an answer? I hope so. Let's return to some previous post-bag topics. Matthew, who got mentioned a little earlier in the episode, he sent me a question last post-bag about early Scots and Welsh recipe manuscripts. Of course, we all know the English one, form of curry. There was an episode about it with Christopher Monk. What about the rest of Britain, the island of Britain? Right, well, I found some answers. First of all, Scotland, the earliest one, 1659, so 17th century. For a historical grounding there, that's kind of around the time of the interregnum. Massive, big, curly periwigs, Great Fire of London. It's from Penarth. It's written in several different people's hands, and the recipes were collected from 1659 to 1734. There's a Welsh one, a manuscript collected by someone called Merrill Williams of the Eustam Colwyn estate. I'm sure I've pronounced that incorrectly. Montgomeryshire. That was written again towards the end of the 17th century and the beginning of the 18th. In fact, exactly the same time. The manuscript is in English, not Welsh. And within its covers, we're given a glimpse of the types of meals created in the kitchens of mid-Wales nobility during the period. So they're both a similar time, and neither of them, having a quick flick through them, are particularly Scottish or Welsh. The handwriting is luckily nice and legible, because it's not always the case, and they're very anglicised. The really traditional food, foods that you may think of as Scottish or Welsh and traditional, are not represented in there. I mean, I've not gone through it with a fine-tooth comb, so I might be wrong, but the really traditional food was probably not being written down at this point. Though they do appear in other sources, like accounts and descriptions, etc. There's one description of Scottish soldiers that comes from the 14th century. It's an observation, really, about them carrying oatmeal for making porridge with them. These are French accounts. Now, the Scottish and the French have always gotten very well because they've had a common enemy in the English. So if you go back over the centuries, Scots and the French were pretty good pals. There's lots of French cooking words in Scots, in modern Scots. Something I've always meant to write a blog post about, so I'm going to add that to my list. Okay, here's an email I accidentally missed off the last postbag, and it's from Liz. Apologies, Liz. She sent me a fantastic clip. It's a video from an old programme called A Taste of Britain, and then there's an episode about Yorkshire pudding. And the clip shows a couple of Yorkshire chaps who have been interviewed about Yorkshire puddings and how they eat it. Have a listen.
The main part of Yorkshire pudding, it ain't like you go in a calf, as like you do now. You get a little bit weird, innit? The Yorkshire people likes that as a course, and all you want with that a bit of good gravy.
It is the finest thing, is Yorkshire pudding with a wild rabbit gravy.
It's really great.
It's lovely to hear the old Yorkshire dialects, which, you know, these days has lessened somewhat. I'm assuming gravy was made out of wild rabbit because it could be caught and it was free, rabbits being pests. You know, there's that Yorkshire stereotype of a guy in a flat cap with a lurcher and a Jack Russell going rabbiting. But people did it. People still do it. Not so commonly, I must admit, but it definitely was a thing. I remember somebody in my street growing up, a friend of mine, his dad used to go out rabbiting with his lurcher and his Jack Russell, and he had a flat cap as well, if I remember. In fact, he also kept pigeons. So he was like maximum Yorkshire. But anyway, yeah, lots of wild rabbits around. Make your gravy out of wild rabbit. Don't be making it out of the best beef. Still on the subject of Yorkshire puddings, Megan Fitzoliver tweeted to say, I knew of one lady insistent that the eggs for a Yorkshire pudding had to be those so fresh that they were still warm from laying. Now, I like these little things because it really just goes to show how important, well, first, the eggs are in the recipe. All that structural protein giving a nice high lift, which is also stable. Sometimes Yorkshire puddings rise up so much, they end up collapsing a bit. But if you've got lots of nice, fresh, gloopy albumin, you're going to make a really nice, high, coronation crown-sized Yorkshire pudding. I've never kept my own chickens, so I don't know if this claim is true. But if anybody out there does keep their own chickens and has made Yorkshire puddings with eggs that are still warm, let me know. How good were they? I thought it would be interesting in a postbag episode if I maybe gave a list of things that I've discovered myself for you to check out. First up, Christopher Monk. Mentioned him before a couple of times, haven't we, today? He's made some short videos with some brilliant recipes and demonstrations of making simple medieval food. I think people think it's all kind of, I don't know, roasted swans and things like that. And of course, in part, it was roasted swans and things. But a lot of the stuff was also simple. And I'm sure you'll agree, the simple ones are the best ones. So he's made half a dozen episodes or so. He's done one on crisples, which is one thing that's always stood out to me when I've read old manuscripts. So I'm glad he's cooked it. Something that I always meant to get around to doing myself. He's also done chicken cooked in milk. He's done a pork chop recipe, almond cakes. It's really good. So go check that out. Now, if you're not a member of the Facebook group, you might have missed that one of the members called Tristan Alfie posted a really great article that he had written called Food as Power Before the Norman Conquest. Anglo-Saxon, stroke early medieval, whatever you want to call it, is so tantalisingly exciting and interesting because we don't know a huge amount. Now, I was supposed to do an episode about Anglo-Saxon food this season. It didn't quite happen. So if you want to learn about Anglo-Saxon food, have a look. It's on his Substack. So you can either go in through the Facebook page, but I'll also leave a link in the show notes. This is what he says. I've taken a quote from it, just to give you a flavour. Food is often invisible. Sometimes we have written records about food habits. Occasionally we have illustrations. Our best shot at understanding diet is through archaeology. And we're talking about this particular period of history. Zoo archaeology, which studies the remains of animals, allows us to begin to put together a picture of what people actually ate. And this is what I love. It's a combination of archaeology, scraps of archaeology. at least when it comes to food, but also scraps of information in the sources and people trying to bring this together. Emma Kay wrote a book called Fodder and Drinken about Anglo-Saxon food. She's done a lot of detective work. So I feel like there's just a little bit, I don't know, bubbling under of a great maybe interest in Anglo-Saxon food. Here's something I found, and I suppose it goes back maybe to the breakfast episode we did with Felicity Cloak in season 4. A guy called Dr. Chung says that the full English breakfast isn't English. I always roll my eyes at these sorts of things. So he reckons bacon is a result of the Danes industrialising the process of rearing pigs in the 19th century. He also says hash browns are very American. They are also, from the point of view of the restaurant, the easiest dish to cook because they're frozen and ready-made. First of all, does anybody think hash browns are English? I've always thought of them as American food. Baked beans are American food as well, of course, although it's been anglicised in this country. I disagree completely with the Danish bacon thing. Yes, they specialise in it now, and they have them for quite a while, but they hardly invented bacon, did they? He also said eggs come from anywhere. Well, if we talk about the actual origins of the modern ingredients we're eating today, well, it's not really an argument. You could apply that to almost anything. Food shipped all around the world. And I would say most of the time our eggs are British, aren't they, if we're in Britain? And anyway, it's about the arrangements of the ingredients, isn't it? It's the way it's put together and that it can be adapted to personal tastes or regional stroke national tastes. Dr. Chung, you don't know what you're talking about, mate. Well, it's time to wrap up. I've been talking for absolutely ages. I'm sick of the sound of my own voice, and I'm sure you are too, listeners. But listen, keep your emails or your social media DMs coming in. Questions, queries, suggestions for future episodes or blog posts. There's going to be a gap now between seasons of maybe, well, a couple of months, because I've got to work on some book ideas. But there's an upcoming Tripe special I've done with Sam Bilton. I'm not sure exactly when that's going to come out, but that's going to come out somewhere between the end of this season and the start of the next one. Keep an eye and an ear out for that one. Also, for anybody who's a subscriber, there's going to be a mini episode coming out, a conversation about jelly making with Ellie from the excellent blog and YouTube channel, The Past is a Foreign Pantry. She went through the rigmarole of making Elizabeth Raffold's calf's foot jelly, and thank goodness, because I thought I was going to have to do it. But it's a great chat anyway, so that's an extra bonus episode that's going to be coming up in the next couple of weeks. There is, of course, going to be lots of stuff on the blogs, quite a large amount of it to do with Elizabeth Raffold and 18th century cooking. There's going to be stuff for everyone. There's going to be stuff for subscribers as well. Now, remember, if you want to support the podcast and blogs and become a subscriber and access all the extra bits and bobs, go to the Support the Blog and Podcast tab on the blog. You'll also get a newsletter with, well, news in it, obviously, but it's also going to have links to all of the content, both free and for subscribers, so you can keep tabs on everything. And of course, please continue, as I know you're already doing, to tell folk, and if you haven't already, to follow, review, and rate the British Food History Podcast. So that's me signing off. I'll see you all soon. Take care of yourselves until next time, please. Cheerio!